The State Board of Elections had ruled Gill didn't receive enough petition signatures to meet legal requirements to appear on the ballot. Gill has run for Congress several times, and he joins us in the studio today. Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, Willis. Thanks for having me.
You turned in more than 11,300 petition signatures. The Elections Board ruled almost 8,600 are valid. The threshold for independent candidates to be ballot listed is 10,754. The threshold for Democrats and Republicans is 740 signatures. You challenged, and last week Federal Judge Sue Myerscough wrote that she wasn't determining what the appropriate number of signatures for an independent should be, but that because you would suffer irreparable harm if you were denied the ballot at this stage of the suit, she ordered the Elections Board not to remove you because of the signature count. Obviously, you're happy she reinstated you to the ballot, but are you disappointed that she didn't address the issue of what an appropriate signature count should be?
No, I'm not disappointed at all. We anticipated that the full lawsuit in which she would make that determination will likely stretch out months, if not a year or two. This, what she did rule on last week, was a preliminary injunction that we had requested, stating that there's four different items that you have to meet in order to be granted such an injunction. The most important of which is that the likelihood is that we would win the case. And so, as she did find within her 26-page opinion, that she feels that the likelihood is high that we will win that case. And so, given that, you know, it was a relatively simple step then for her to go on and grant us the injunction.
The Illinois Attorney General's office immediately appealed that ruling. Were you expecting that, and is that disappointing to you?
I was 50-50. I didn't know, you know, frankly, I think that it's a no-brainer that we succeed with this case, and we can talk about that in as much detail as you'd like, Willis. But there's several prongs to our approach with regards to deeming that signature requirement unconstitutional, and some of which are just really indefensible on the state's part. And so, I didn't know if they would. I think it's a waste of taxpayers' money, frankly, for them to appeal it, especially when they were arguing that we're up against that. One of the reasons they didn't think she should grant the injunction was that we're up against deadlines here, and people's efforts and resources will be wasted. And well, they're going on and wasting the taxpayers' money by appealing something that they ultimately cannot win. And yeah, I was disappointed. It's you know, it'd be nice to have a flat out win, but now we've got another week or two of kind of wondering how it's going to play out. Although 80 to 90% of the time, the appellate courts affirm the lower court's rulings, and especially in cases like this, it would be pretty unusual for them to overturn it.
And if they overturn it, what will be your next step?
Well, what it goes before first is a three-judge panel. And if we were to lose at that level, we could ask for what they call en banc, the full roster of judges on that appellate court to hear the case. And of course, all of this would have to move very fast. The ballots need to be printed now in a couple of weeks or so. They need to be mailed out to military overseas on September 23rd. So I would assume that we would pursue that if we lost within that appellate judge panel. And if we were to not succeed at that level, the next step would be Supreme Court. But really, for all practical purposes, they're not in session, and I don't know that they're interested in hearing this on a rush basis.
Some observers may ask, why are you spending so much time and effort and money on this process? You lost three other congressional races. As an independent, your chances of winning seem slim. What do you tell these people?
Well, I've lost in the past, but I think that the voters have not outright rejected me. I ran three times in a district where you can't win. I ran as a Democrat in a place where the Democrat is invariably going to lose 2-1 or 3-1. And we did, you know, we got up to 42%. I always did 5-10 points better than the standard Democrat. And I thought that I was done speaking out, so to speak, running for office. And with redistricting in 2012, there was what I saw as an opportunity to take one shot in a district where things were more balanced, the new Illinois 13. And for all intents and purposes, I'm firmly of the belief that I won that election, but ironically, for the presence of another independent. There was a guy out there who was saying all the same things I was saying about climate change and gay marriage and a woman's right to choose and term limits and campaign finance reform and single-payer health care. The list goes on, and I was running against myself and Rodney Davis. And ultimately, me won the race by 7 points, but unfortunately, that guy got 7.2%, and I lost by 0.3 percentage point in the final count. So
1,002 votes,
right,
to be
out of 300,000 votes. And so I don't think that it's been a pointless endeavor to this point. You know, I think that if I was running in a place where Democrats win on a regular basis and I was losing race after race, then I think, you know, there'd be an element of foolishness. And I would agree with those people that would criticize me. But, you know, it's become clear to me that I'm not one of the favorite sons of the Democratic Party. I had to knock them off in the primary in 2012. They dared me to do it again in 2014. And it was at that point that I said, you know, if I have to keep beating my own party, maybe it's not my party anymore. So you made
a conscious decision not to run in 2014. What went into that decision?
It was difficult. Feeling that I had won in 2012, other than that independent who was preaching all that I was preaching, it was eye-opening, Willis, to be frank with you, to see a party say, you know, you won, but we don't want to go with you again. I had had my concerns about the Democratic Party all my adult, you know, the last 10, 20 years, the last quarter centuries, for that matter. And that was sort of the final straw for me, that they would turn their backs on a congressional district that we had just, for all intents and purposes, won, and decide to put in somebody who ultimately proved to be not a very successful candidate. She lost by 50 to 60 times what I lost by. And they didn't come calling after that either. And
well, based on the theory that you just laid out about an independent basically blocked you from winning in 2012, could Mark Wicklund, the Democratic opponent this time, make that argument about you as an independent?
No, and I think for a couple of reasons. There's a couple of significant differences between the 2012 race and this race. Number one, that guy back in 2012, when you looked at polling data, that independent never saw double digits. He 7.2 was as big as he ever got, high as he ever got in a poll. And whereas when we've done polling, we've demonstrated that I'm extremely competitive in this race as an independent. Secondly, as I indicated, that independent wasn't saying anything different than the two major party candidates. He was preaching exactly what I was out there saying, whereas I've got ideas to offer that are not being offered by Mr. Wicklund or Mr. Davis.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kernan. We're visiting with 13th Congressional District Independent candidate David Gill, who last week won a court ruling allowing him to appear on the November ballot. You won your appeal, yet the independent MAP people, who want district boundaries determined by a less political process, lost their appeal. How do you reconcile these two decisions?
I don't know that they're reconcilable, other than they were different sets of judges. You know, you had the Illinois Supreme Court and you had Judge Myerscough, and I was very, very disappointed in that other ruling last week. Like 80% of Illinoisans, I think that I would like to see that on the ballot.
Rodney Davis, we mentioned him. He's the incumbent Republican who first reached the office by defeating you by a very narrow margin in 2012, has raised more than $2 million, while your campaign has brought in a little more than $16,000, with Democrat Mark Wicklund raising a little more than $19,000, according to OpenSecrets.org. How can you win a race that's monetarily handicapped in such a fashion?
It's doable. I mean, I was outspent 5-1 in that 2012 primary. I was outspent in the 2012 general and still, for all intents and purposes, won, as we've discussed. And to be frank with you, we've been fortunate to raise what little that we have raised, given that I haven't been able to establish my presence on the ballot to this point. You know, I would point to Mr. Wicklund and say, you know, what's that? You've been on the ballot for 8 months. You know, in December, you filed your signatures and you were the only Democrat. And this is, you've raised essentially what I've raised as a non-candidate, so to speak. We've just gotten started Friday, the day after Judge Myerscough's ruling came out, with significant fundraising. And we're hoping to at least get into a place with fundraising where we can achieve what we need to achieve. We've got a significant ground game going. The signature collection effort, it was very difficult. Nobody enjoyed it for 90 days, getting out there in the early on in the rain and the cold, and later on in the constant 90-degree humidity. But it really served multiple purposes, one of which was person-to-person contact. Yeah, I collected 5,000 of those signatures myself, so I probably had 10 to 12,000 little conversations with people, and there's nothing like individual contact. And So we believe that I can be outspent here 5-1 or 10-1 and still win the thing.
Davis has recently been selected to serve in an advisory capacity on agricultural issues for Donald Trump's campaign. Some think that anyone who refuses to rebuke Trump, whose comments have been interpreted as racially bigoted and misogynistic, are in fact signing off on those positions themselves. Here's how Davis reacted to that when GLT News asked him about it.
You know, the question you just asked is it's a pretty pointed and loaded question that unfortunately I can only respond by saying I don't agree with any politician of either party 100% of the time on any issue.
So does that free Davis to support Trump as an agriculture advisor without bearing the burden of the brazen statements that the standard bearer has made?
No. And in fact, we intend to talk a great deal these next 10 weeks about his connections to Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump is a special individual in the way in which he has conducted himself during his presidential campaign. I'm not out here to endorse any of the other three individuals running for president, but I am here to say that that man's not fit to be president, given what he's had to say about John McCain and disabled individuals and families of Gold Star soldiers. I think he's brought great shame upon the whole process, and for my opponent, Rodney Davis, to back him and, in fact, to work on his behalf speaks volumes about Mr. Davis. And so we intend to talk about that at great length over the next 10 weeks.
Trump has talked about the election being a rigged system. You have used the term rigged system. So do you agree with Trump in that regard?
Well, I don't know what he's talking about, to be frank with you. I'm not sure. I know what I'm talking about. In the sense that I was asked to get 15 times the number of signatures as the Democrat and the Republican. I was asked to get far more signatures, relatively speaking, than an independent who would run for the United States Senate. You know, a clear violation of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause. So it's decidedly rigged. Nobody trying to achieve what I've achieved has ever succeeded. There's nobody in Illinois that's ever been able to get the 10,754 signatures to run as an independent for U.S. House. One guy got the signatures back 42 years ago, but he had more than 90 days. He had 180 days or more to collect the signatures. We only had 90. They put that extra burden in place in the early 1980s. So it's clearly rigged with regards to my ability to get on the ballot, and I'm not sure, to be frank with you, what Mr. Trump is referring to when he calls it a rigged system.
I'm Willis Kern at Sound Ideas, and we're visiting with David Gill, who is the 13th District Congressional Independent candidate. Let's talk about some issues. In the past, you've been critical of President Obama's Affordable Care Act. You're a physician. Now that it's been in effect for a few years, how do you think it has worked or not worked?
I don't think it's the answer. You know, again, as I've said repeatedly, there's a couple of nice elements in there of not keeping people out because of pre-existing conditions, letting your children be on your policy till they're 26. But at the end of the day, that's all they are, is a couple of nice little provisions. They're not. It's not a solution to the problems that we face. And in fact, we've seen increased burden on people trying to buy policies as individuals. The premium keeps escalating tremendously. It's supposed to go up another 25% to 50% this November. We've seen insurance companies not be able to participate. We find insurance companies dropping out. We see the emergency department has become ever busier because you can give people insurance, but that's not necessarily providing them with health care. We have a whole lot of people that come in with sore throats and little scrapes that don't need to be in an emergency department. They don't need to be coming into a place where it costs $2,000 to walk through the door, but they have nowhere to turn oftentimes because they have insurance, but they don't have the kind of insurance. They have a public aid card that private physicians they'd rather see somebody where they're going to make more money. And I'm not here judging anybody, but I'm just here to say that the system as it has developed with the ACA is not what we need.
Well, the president obviously stated that some major concessions were needed in order to get something passed. Do you disagree that these changes are better than the previous status quo?
Oh, I think it's plus minus. There's a couple nice things, but it's so very far short of where we need to be that it's hardly worth staying in this place. On the other hand, this sort of knee-jerk reaction on the part of Republicans who have, 50-plus times said, you know, replace and repeal or whatever it is they keep voting for, while the man it's named after is still sitting there in the White House and will obviously pull out his veto pen immediately if they ever were to achieve something like that. I think that's game playing on the part of Republicans. I think we need folks in Washington that are not game players, and that's part of my effort in running as an independent. You know, I'm focused on solutions that work, and we can do much better with respect to the way we finance and provide health care in America.
Should Merrick Garland have hearings and be sworn in as a U.S. Supreme Court justice?
By all means. I mean, I just can't believe it. It boggles my mind to see people absolve themselves of their responsibility. And again, I would say the same thing if it was a Republican president and a Democratic Senate. It's again, talk about game playing. That's major game playing, and that's serious, significant game playing that's undermining our ability to conduct our business in this country.
Your campaign website has a section that's captioned "Taxed Enough Already," which, of course, is the basis for an acronym of a segment of primarily the Republican Party. Are you out here to capture Tea Party voters?
I am out here to capture any voters I can get, Willis, to be frank with you. And I think that some of the things that people within the Tea Party talk about, I agree with them. You know, I think that, and I think a lot of the economic populism that Donald Trump has spouted, I agree with. I just don't necessarily buy it coming from the mouth of a billionaire or a millionaire, whatever he is. But I agree that these free trade, so-called free trade pacts, have really undermined the economic security of the vast majority of Americans. And I believe that the vast majority of Americans are taxed enough already, that we can do better if we had the Wall Street banks and the big multinational corporations that fund the two major parties paying their fair share and engaging in some type of civic responsibility.
So is that the extent of where you would point to on the Tea Party plank and say, that's what I like, or is there more?
Well, I think they like the Second Amendment, and I'm very much a backer of the Second Amendment. I think they like the idea of term limits, and I've been talking about term limits for as long as I've been running for office. I'm a big believer in term limits. I'm open to suggestions. I mentioned briefly the fact that people have to come to the ER and spend $2,000. There's a ridiculous law in place that provides for that. It's called EMTALA. I don't ever hear a Republican or a Democrat talk about EMTALA, but in emergency departments across this country, healthcare providers are gnashing their teeth over the fact that they're trying to take care of people having heart attacks and strokes and are bogged down with sore throats and hangnails because of EMTALA, and the waste that goes into that, I think would, were it to be discussed and focused upon as a campaign issue, I think Tea Party individuals would say, boy, Dr. Gill, he knows what he's talking about there.
You mentioned the Second Amendment. Would you agree that the recent outbreak over the last few years, and going back to Newtown or even further, of mass shootings has changed the public's opinion of how gun laws should be structured in this country?
I don't know. You know, I talk to individuals, Willis, and it's very variable. And I am a firm believer that that those are individuals engaged in those acts. And I'm a firm believer that we're 80 or 80 years or a century behind with regards to addressing this issue, if we ever were to address it. And I don't mean to be overly cynical or pessimistic, but those guns are out there. And I really believe that you're not going to round them all up. I don't want to round any of them up. There's so many guns out there illegally. And I think at this late date to talk about going back and retrieving all those and altering what's going on here, it's not about guns. It's about people at the end of the day. And I don't think writing additional gun legislation will help us achieve what it is that we're looking to achieve.
So you would be against legislation that, let's say, closes the gun show loophole?
Yeah, at this point, yes. I'd have to have it demonstrated to me that writing laws like that actually does something good. You know, I found it very interesting when the debate was going on with regards to concealed carry in Illinois, that I saw actual data with regards to what happens to crime rates when you pass concealed carry. And state after state, crime rates went down, contrary to what some of those who would have us regulate guns more tightly would tell you. And so I think it's a far more complex issue than what we sense when we respond in an emotional manner to some of these obviously tragic things that take place. And, I think that I'm open to listening to all sides, but to this point, my gut instinct tells me that we're talking about people and tragedies inflicted by people. It's not so much what type of weapon that they select.
How should the U.S. best combat the terrorist threats of ISIS or other radical groups?
Well, I think we need to alter the entire our entire approach to foreign policy. You know, I think you and I may have been talking. I started running in 2003, just before we invaded Iraq, and I was arguing against the invasion of Iraq and talking about the chaos that would ensue in taking such an unnecessary step. And we've seen that come to pass. And so I think that our large footprint throughout the Middle East needs to be drawn back even further. And I don't think you're going to bomb ISIS into non-existence, as some would have us do. I think that we have to simply be a responsible global player, as it were, and stop trying to dictate what's going on in different parts of the world, and recognize that we are not going to be loved by all people, and that there are things that we can't solve. You know, there's the battles going on in the Middle East between Palestinians and Israelis. That stuff that's a couple millennia old, and I don't think the United States, even through diplomatic efforts, is going to ultimately solve that type of problem.
So if you were sitting in Congress, would you advise the president then to just turn his back on Syria, for instance?
At this point in time, I sure wouldn't send troops in. You know, I think providing economic assistance to those who are struggling is appropriate, but I don't think it's a place for our military to get involved. I felt the same way with respect to when the drum beats of war were starting up again with regards to getting involved in Libya, and I thought that would be unwise.
David Gill is an emergency room physician from Bloomington. He's making his fourth run for Congress, this time as an independent candidate in Illinois' 13th district. Thanks so very much for being here. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, Willis. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
I'm Willis Kern.